in space.
Well, that's a different measurement of distances. That's miles. This is just another unit of distance. This is the distance that light will travel unopposed in a vacuum after one, quote, year, end quote. So the question is, who's kind of judging what that year really means?
That beats me, because otherwise I probably would have known what the actual distance could be for a light year, but nah, completely different thing. Never mind.
Okay, so I'm just going by definitions that because there are actually different definitions for a year, depending upon cultures and times and places and all kinds of fun stuff. I mean, a year today is not exactly the same thing as a year 2,000 years ago, unfortunately. Not that things are slowing down or speeding up, but definitions are shifting around.
And white switch.
Yes, Lou.
So again, not to give away the store, because I kind of cheated on this one and looked at Uncle Google, but the Emperor Caesar might have something to do with this.
Yes, indeed, Lou. That's quite correct. But the interesting thing is everyone who offered an answer offered the right answer, but described it sort of the wrong way. The concept that a year is exactly 365 and a quarter days is not a Gregorian calendar concept. It's a Julian calendar concept.
As in Julius Caesar.
Yes, indeed, Lou, as in Julius Caesar. So the puzzle was to point out that for arbitrary reasons, when people sat down and decided to define a light year, they took the Julian calendar as the basis for a year and not the Gregorian. So if you think in terms of 1 year is what the Gregorian calendar sets up, which requires a little bit of adjustment anyway, unfortunately, because none of these things are perfect. Gregorian is much better suited than Julian, but light years are defined in less accurate Julian years than Gregorian years. So that was a bit of the puzzle.
WB2KWC?
Yes, Cap.
Okay, I'm gonna say we're talking about the wrong things. I'm not sure we should be talking about a calendar as opposed to elapsed time. Basically, you know, the calendar, as we see, the calendar has changed or went to a Julian calendar, whatever. However, elapsed time, the amount of time it takes the Earth to go around the Sun has not changed, and it's completely independent of the calendar system we're using.
That's true, but that isn't the basis for the definition of a light year. It's the calendar description of a year that's used in the description of a light year. Again, all these calendars attempt to approximate the reality of our solar system, and they all get it wrong to a varying degree. Over time, they're more and more accurate, and more and more fiddly bits added on. But ultimately, it's true what you say. But when people discuss a light year, they're not exactly talking about the distance it takes the Earth to go around one orbit. They're talking about really 365 and one quarter Earth days.
I understand that, and I actually cheated, and I just went and looked things up. And they really talk nothing about calendar. What they talk about is the year that they define is the time that it takes the sun to go from one position to exactly the same position relative to other stars, rather than, you know, for it to go from January to January.
Okay, I mean, I saw it defined as 365 and a quarter. As Ed pointed out, we're kind of splitting things because, you know, it's kind of so large, it's really difficult to wrap your head around it. But I'll look into it further. Again, I got it from some reference sources, but I'll look again and make sure that that it's 365 and a quarter.
Okay, and as we all know, looking it up on the internet is not a guarantee that you're getting a correct answer.
No, it's not. This came from books, actually, but sometimes I really like to give a puzzle where the first answer on a Google search is the wrong answer. So I appreciate that fact. You always need a good BS meter when you're referencing material, especially on the internet.
That is, I didn't mean to, you know, for it to be a dig at you. I mean, any of us, you know, when we look something up on the internet and we see something, as you said, you got to use your BS meter.
And to RVP.
Yes, Russell? Yes, Russell, you wanted to say something?
That was not me.
Oh, I'm sorry. Whoever it was who wanted to say something, I'm sorry that I didn't recognize you. Please transmit.
Matt, that's your turn.
W2NDR, you know, a lot at the flea markets. One of my ham friends, my 133-foot dipole came down from the storm. He put it back up. It works great. He gave me an old R7. So it's got a 4-to-1 balun. I could tune it barely on 40. Maybe I can get 3-to-1 the best. But it does great on 10. It's got a trap. I figured if it falls down from, I think I might have a 5/8 wave, 11-meter antenna from Archer. My dad had. He never used it. I could maybe use it for 10 meters. But for now, I'm using this. I'm going to try. It works great on 10 meters. I tuned it, and I got 1-to-1 SWR. So it's a 10-meter drop bay on Tuesday. So hopefully it'll get me up to 10 meters because I can't even hear anything with the dipole. Back to net.
Okay. Was there a question, or you just wanted to mention that?
Yeah, I asked Matt. I sent him a text, and I said, look, he says, Matt, he told me it's got a 4-to-1 balun. So is a normal, say, on your standard dipole, a 2-to-1 balun? He said it's got a 4-to-1 balun in that antenna. I guess it's got a box. I guess that's the balun that gives it, you know, the so it could give you, see, 50 ohms.
Yeah, it depends upon the design of the antenna what the nominal impedance is. If you just take a regular dipole in free space, in the center feed is about 73 ohms, and as you slide it towards one end or the other, the impedance goes up. Or as I mentioned last week, if you cut it in half and turn it into a vertical, you're basically cutting the impedance from 73 to half of that, is around 36 ohms. So it sort of depends upon the impedance of the design of your particular antenna. If your particular antenna has an output impedance of 200 ohms, in order to match your coax and the transmitter output, you need a 4-to-1 balun. Otherwise, you will have a mismatch and reflections and inefficiencies.
Yeah, it's a 2 ohm divided 4, so it makes it like 50 ohms. So you have to see 50 ohms. Yeah, it works. I mean, it's an old thing. He got it with some of a friend of his that was a solid key, and boy, it's a big antenna. I mean, you have to see this thing on the roof. It's like, oh my God, going up looking at it, you know? Yeah, the tough part of getting it, he had to put the mast, and he had to put the two pieces, and then he had to slide it over the mast. But I figured, you know, I could use the lease, you know, for some of the bands on, you know, with the vertical. But I got good reports with my dipole, you know. It came down, but he put a spring on it, but he put it through an eyelet, you know, he screwed it into the tree. It's got a spring, so it gets some tension, and the tree sways. But we got it up there, and it looks great.
Okay, I'm glad it's working for you. You know, any antenna that you can get to resonate is better than none. So wish you luck with that.
Yeah, it's funny. I was trying to. There was a guy calling. There was a W0EE. He was calling. I think he was in He was in Missouri. He was calling. It was a contest or something. So I was trying to get him on 40 with the R7. I get a random wire. I put my tune on that, and the audio came up so much. I mean, a random wire is not that high up, but it does work. It's like my backup in case something happens with the dipole, you know. Maybe next time we could raise, maybe once the leaves fall off the trees, maybe we could put better rope on it to raise it up more. But it's working good. I'll be on the Breakfast Club net tomorrow with the 180. So I was trying to get on 20 with the R7. Wasn't much on 20.
Okay, very good. Once again, I wish you luck. If things get change or get better or you're able to string it higher, I'm sure it'll get even better.
The dipole's 30 feet up in the air, which is good. You know, it's got some height there, you know. So I'll have to look for some DX and see how I do with it.
Okay, very good. Well, once again, we wish you luck. This again is AC2GS with the Limark Technical Net. If anyone has any comments about previous material or anything new that they'd like to ask or talk about or mention, please give me your first name and your call sign. Okay, maybe we'll do a couple of science talk articles. One more call. If anyone else has any questions or topics or comments tonight for the TechNet, please give me your first name and your call sign.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Oh, okay. That time you heard me. I'm a little trouble from Selden. Okay. No, I was just going to talk about the light year deal. Astronomers like to use parsec, you know, that's like a little over 3 light years, but they you know, consider it a distance, so they'd rather use that. It eliminates the ambiguity of the light year to some degree. So back to you, Mark.
Well, it's actually something that to a degree they could measure. A parsec is a 1 second of parallax optically. So if you have something that's 1 second off on parallax, it means that it's 1 parsec away from you. So you could measure those things. You can't really measure a light year. A light year is an interesting concept to give people, but ultimately there's no kind of way of measuring things like that. You can measure either using a parallax and parsecs, or you can infer it if you have stars of known brilliance, and then you can figure out the distance and then translate them into light years. But parsecs are a very nice actual hard and fast measurement, at least for nearby structures. When you get farther away and the parallax becomes smaller and smaller and smaller, it becomes much more difficult.
Okay, very good. Yeah, I know. They take it at one AU, one astronomical unit, and whatever that one arc second it is, that comes out to a little over three and a quarter light years. But then now you talk about light years again. But they go by distance. So okay, but I mean that eliminates some of that problem. I think they might have gone from one calendar to another. But I think the latest was the Julian calendar. But that could be a problem.
Yeah, I don't think they used the calendar that went before the Julian. That really goes, that predates into BC. So the Greeks, if anyone, would be using that measurement. They probably just settled on quick and simple, you know, 365 days and settled for that. What can I tell you?
Okay, very good. Yeah, well, whatever country came up with it first. I think Germany came out with light year first. Whatever they were using. Okay, very good. Back to you.
Okay. I mean, that would be curious. I assume it was some European concept at first. I don't know. That's a good thing to look up as well. Once again, AC2GS, Roy here. This is the Landmark Technical Math. If anyone has any comments about anything we've discussed or any new comments or topics or questions or such, please feel free to hit that push the talk button and give me your first name and your call sign.
KD2NVB with a question about parsecs.
Okay, Bob, what's your question about parsecs?
Yeah, I never heard of one before, so when you're talking about parallax, and I understand parallax and degrees and seconds, but in relation to what? I can't wrap my head around this. Like, what would 360 be, for example?
That would probably be exactly where you're standing.
Okay, but I'm still in the dark about all this. I mean, somehow going all the way. I don't get it. I mean, I just don't get it. Maybe I'll look it up sometime.
What they tend to do is they calculate the location of an object in space at one end of the year. Then when the Earth is orbiting the other side of the orbit, they take another measurement of the same object. And they then take a look to see what's the difference in angle. And obviously, the farther out, the more it's parallel. So the angle becomes narrower and narrower and narrower. So 1 second of parallax using that method gives you an object that's one parsec away from you who is examining it on a rotating Earth. Yes, Ed.
I have it on Wikipedia right in front of me, and to tell you the truth, it would probably take me 2 hours to figure this out. The short story, a parsec is 3.3 light years, which is roughly 19 trillion miles, and 210,000 times the distance of the Earth to the Sun. That's right.
Okay, yeah, I mean, they've done the conversion, but I gather from Bob that he wanted to kind of hopefully know the concept of how anyone came up with the idea of a second of parallax.
NVB.
Yes, Bob.
Yeah, I get it. That's simple. Yeah, I just didn't know anything about what a parsec, what you meant, what you just said. Oh, yes, one side of the orbit to the other. Okay, I get it. Cool. So very good. That's very interesting. Back to you, Roy. Back to Ned.
Ed, you don't like my answer?
length of the short plane is at the Earth, and the angle at the other side is 1,300 degrees. That's 1 second apart. So the brakes would be down. Out to be, like I said, 210,000 miles short end, or 19 trillion miles, or 3.3 light years.
Okay, but you sort of still need to make the measurements when the Earth is at different points in its orbit in order to draw the triangle correctly.
The opening parallel doesn't go into it that far.
Okay, but there's a nice illustration to the right where it shows the Earth. It shows it's one AU distance from the Sun. It shows it going round and round, and shows the angles produced by the center and the edge of the orbit and intersecting into the angle which is the parallax angle.
Yeah, but you're saying that the Earth's orbit is not, I assume what you're saying, the Earth's orbit is not entirely circular, so it changes. So I assume it's using the average. I'm seeing nothing about that here in Wikipedia.
No, I'm not saying that, it's an ellipse, it's not exactly a circle, but the point is that I think what they end up doing, because they can't really measure directly the sun's line, is that they measure from two extremes, and they extrapolate the center, and one end is a leg of a triangle.
Yeah.
That's all that I'm alluding to. That unfortunately, because we can't really measure the angle from the sun, we have to extrapolate, and we use two values when the Earth is on either sides of its orbit.
Basically, yeah. I think it's the average distance from the Earth to the Sun, which is colloquially 93 million miles, although I suspect that's not precise.
Yeah, they pretty much define it as the triangle being one leg is one AU in distance, so they're taking the average.
Yes, agreed.
Okay, very good, Ed. So we agree. Parsecs are interesting things. We kind of touched on it years ago when I think it was Kay who brought up the interesting question of how the heck we know how far things are. And we went into this whole thing about how there are stars that there are supernovas that explode with a given known intensity, and there are stars that blink on and off that have a known intensity. And by figuring out that intensity, you can get the distance, and those are how we know farther objects. Close objects we learn from just parallax differences.
Doesn't the expansion in the universe and the redshift enter into that?
Well, the redshift will just shift the photon energies down. They won't really change the amplitude, so the intensity shouldn't really be shifted, just the frequency. Okay, I mean, redshift is the reason why our cosmic microwave background is a microwave. When it started out, it was a lot more energetic, but it Doppler shifted itself all the way down to the microwave range.
No, I'm just referring to is As the theories on the expansion of the universe vary, they can use the Doppler redshift to estimate the distance of stuff.
Yeah, well, they can, but it's sort of the chicken and the egg that they actually use the other ways of telling the distances and how it correlated with redshifting to sort of prove that everything is actually speeding up instead of slowing down.
The answer is, boy, for you to pace off the distance to Alpha Centauri and report back to us.
Okay, that's going to take a little time, but I don't know exactly how you pace off in space, though. That would be a problem.
That's why I'm giving it to you to figure it out.
Okay, very good. I mean, the problem with science fiction is that distances in space are humongous, and the closest planets we have are in the Alpha Centauri system, and they're still damn far away. So that's why, ultimately, everyone comes up with these devilish ideas of warp drive and faster-than-light travel, because otherwise it all becomes meaningless. No one's going to book a flight if their great-great-grandchildren are going to land on some planet, maybe. So that's the problem with space being so darn big.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
One good thing now about knowing about the Parsec is when you watch these science fiction shows, these space shows, Star Trek, and they mention Parsec, you know, we'll know they're talking about distance. That's the most important thing I think we learned. The parallax goes out to, they got that out to around 200 light years ago, and they're doing a little bit better now, but 200 light years, and then they switched over to the Cepheid stars. They could tell by looking at those stars, the brightness of it, they knew that it was, you know, wherever it was, the brightness was the same, so inverse square law, they were able to tell, you know, a lot further out than now 200 light years out, they can go out, you know, millions of light years, all the way until they found one in Alpha Centauri, and they realized that Alpha Centauri wasn't a nebula, it was a galaxy, and they realized they guessed at 1 million, but it turns out to be over 2 million light years away. And then from after that, then they got involved with the redshift. So that's roughly how they did it. And then now they are stepped past that, now they're into supernovas. Back to you, Roy, WS1.
Paul, don't you mean Andromeda?
Yeah, I didn't say Andromeda. What did I say?
You said Alpha Centauri.
I get that on my mind. Yeah, Alpha Centauri. Yeah, that's only a little over one parsec. It's about 4 light years away. Yeah, yes, Alpha, the galaxy Andromeda. They thought it was a nebula, and they realized when they saw that Cepheid star there, they figured out, wow, that thing is way out there. They guessed at 1 million, and it turned out to be 2 million, but that was close enough.
Yeah, Cepheids are variable stars as well, so they kind of blink, and you can tell all kinds of useful information from that. And there's one particular type of supernova, I don't remember if it's a 1A or a 2A, that's also kind of always approximately the same intensity when it goes off. So that's another one that you can plug into an intensity equation and come out with a distance. So it's sort of amazing that we've been able to cobble together as much as we know of the observable universe, because we know that there's a certain point that the light hasn't reached us yet, and that's part of the universe that is unobservable to us, because the light isn't reaching us yet, and probably in some places never will. So the universe is bigger probably than the observable universe, but we don't know by how much.
Yeah, that's super number. That are 1As, the 1As. When they got into that, by examining those things in different galaxies, they realized that the universe is expanding. And it's not only that, accelerating. So that's what we're up to now.
Back to you. Yeah, it really ruined a lot of theoreticians when they came back and they said, guys, it's not doing what you say it's supposed to be doing. You know, back in Einstein's day, he actually plugged in the astronomical constant into his major equation because he believed in a solid-state universe, that it wasn't expanding, it wasn't shrinking, it was just steady. So he put a fudge factor in by the constant. And then people figured out that, no, it seems to be, things seem to be going away from us. So they came up with the Big Bang idea, and they came up with the fact that initially the velocity was great, but then gravity would have its effect, and things would slow down, and then it would collapse and have a big crunch, and then a big boom. Big Bang and a big crunch, and there's an oscillating universe. And then finally they put the numbers together and said, oops, it's not slowing down, it's speeding up. So now we have to come up with another new theory.
That goes to show you, Einstein shows that the first thought that comes to your mind is usually right.
Well, although it's settled with the astronomical constant, it's just going in a different direction. So, who knows? Brilliant guy, not the best mathematician, never confessed to be the greatest mathematician, used a lot of some of the greatest mathematicians' material. Used a lot of work from a guy called Lorentz, who is a brilliant mathematician, who, amusingly enough, didn't believe in relativity. So even though Einstein used his equations to explain the way that space-time warps using Lorentz transforms. The guy who came up with the Lorentz transforms thought it was all nonsense. So go figure.
WB2EAD.
Yes, Ed.
I have a theory. You're the physicist. I want you to tell me where I'm wrong. Einstein's theory of relativity came about when Einstein realized that everybody had been telling him all his life that time is fixed and immutable, and he said, well, let's see what happens if time isn't fixed and immutable, and that's really a relativity at its core.
Well, I mean, it's an important component. I think equally was there had been arguments for 100 years since Newton's time whether there is such a thing as a distance is an absolute number either. And if there are such things as absolute reference points, you know, are you able to definitively say this is a static reference point to everything? And part of relativity is ultimately that nothing is an inherent point in space and or time. That time and space are warpable, adjustable, and that one frame of reference is just as legitimate as another frame of reference. So that's kind of the big picture of relativity. It was also that space wasn't the constant. In the old days with Newton, he really would have wanted references and reference points, and unfortunately, Einstein blew that all up.
I have a addition to my theory that the variability in distance in space comes out of time being variable, but I am not going to defend that. That's just a gut feeling and nothing more, and I truly admit it.
Okay, but since time is kind of a fourth dimension, there's no real equivalent, you know, equals MC squared type of thing, where energy and matter are just different forms of each other. You would have to kind of say that space is time and time is space, and that gets very, very strange. They're all kind of mixed together. It's like electromagnetism. You can't really have magnetism alone. Again, it depends on your frame of reference. If you pick a different frame of reference, your magnetic field looks like an electric field. If you change that frame of reference, it looks like an electromagnetic field. So time and space are kind of mushed together. So whether you could say that it's time that's the important stuff and the space is just secondary is sort of like saying that the magnetic field is much more important than the electric field in an electromagnetic wave.
Yes, you can't divorce that. By the way, just for a fun fact, E equals MC squared is incomplete. E equals MC squared divided by the square root of 1 minus E squared over C squared.
E equals MC squared is a special case at a zero reference velocity. So what you just gave me was the energy of an object that had an inherent momentum, whereas the simpler equation that most people memorize is for an object at rest.
Oh, I agree 100%, but the main reason for the fame of E equals MC squared, it's the only equation Einstein ever wrote that doesn't go across the page several times.
I guess so. It is not the most famous one to physicists. There's a much longer one that's later on in his theory, but for some odd reason, E equals MC squared kind of grabbed everyone's imagination. So if you want to look smart on and you have a blackboard near you, just scribble E equals MC squared. People will be impressed.
No, that's too trite. Throw in the square root of 1 minus E squared over C squared. That'll impress people. They won't know what he's talking about. You won't know what he's talking about, but it's impressive.
Hey, my third grade Catholic nun was not impressed by E equals MC squared. One, whitey white.
Okay, well, yeah, again, you had a tough crowd. Physicists would laugh at you, but Joe Public, who basically sort of knows that, because I've even seen that on cartoons, those guys would be impressed. Again, it wouldn't impress any physicist. You know, it would be like saying 1 plus 1 equals 2.
Wait a minute, YBY brought up an interesting point.
Yes, Ed?
The question is, was creation 5,781 years ago yesterday, or I believe we're up to 6,086 on a papal calendar?
May I comment in one whitey way?
Certainly.
So the same third grade nun who was not terribly impressed with this was even less impressed one day about 15 years ago when she walked onto an airplane that I was flying.
Did she get off?
Of course not.
Well, what do you want? She just saw you as that little kid in the classroom. And, you know, little kids shouldn't be flying planes, even if, unfortunately, they did grow up. But, yeah, again, I think that's why kind of parents are sort of surprised at their kids being grown-ups all of a sudden. Because for a long time, they just keep those memories of those kids drooling in their bassinets.
Well, actually, you hit the nail on the head. The nun's traveling companion was another nun who verbally reminded her that time went past from the time that I was in her class.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's tough to get people to think in terms like that. They kind of lock people down in their minds, and there's a lot of memory inertia, I tend to call it.
You want to know how Einstein defined time?
Certainly, Ed.
So help me, this is his exact words. He went on the record with this. When I am talking to a pretty young lady, time goes amazingly fast. When I'm uncomfortably hot or cold, time goes amazingly slow.
Yes, I've read that as well, Ed. That's the concept of time. Human beings and organic things generally are very bad timekeepers. The flow of time depends upon other factors with us. Never use a human being as a time standard. But yeah, all things are relative. Especially, I remember days that went by in seconds and seconds that went by in days. This last few years has been kind of slow as far as I've perceived it.
And time comes to a complete stop when you're in the dentist's chair.
Especially with the nitrous oxide.
I can't improve on that.
Time dilation is an interesting concept. You can get a wee bit blue sky, but I like blue skies. If you perceive the world through the eyes of an electromagnetic wave, they're traveling at the speed of light. So if you plug in the Lorentz transforms, as far as the photon is concerned, absolutely no time is going on. A photon does not exist over time. Time stops for it. So that's one of the many things that make you want to scratch your brain to figure out what the hell that means.
So is that why photons never make appointments?
Well, it's one of the reasons why they're self-propagating. Since they don't have a lifespan, since time is irrelevant, there's nothing really to stop them in time. They can get stopped by banging against something in space, but not time. Well, once again, this is AC2GS. My name is Roy, and this is the Limark Technical Net. We've taken a little segue into relativity, which I actually like. There's a whole bunch of concepts of that gravity is not actually a true force, but is a aspect of the simple concept of time dilation. As you get closer to a gravitational field, the flow of time around you is slower than the flow of time that's not interacting with that gravitational field. And to us, we can't perceive time dilation. Instead, we feel a force, which is why our air conditioner is heavy to us.
That goes back to what I was saying before, that a lot of relativity comes out of time not being fixed.
Yes, I agree with you. The problem, again, is that space and time are kind of smooshed together. I mean, that's another big concept of relativity because, you know, up until that point, people kind of, this is space and that's time. They're two different things. They don't interact, but they actually do interact. And there's some fascinating subject called, well, there's momentum. Most everyone knows about momentum, MV. Momentum is conserved. Linear momentum is conserved. There's something called four momentum, which is momentum in space-time itself, and that's actually conserved as well. So if you speed up in velocity through space, you slow down your trip through time. So again, if you were able to travel at the highest speed through space, which would be the speed of light, your travel through time itself would go to zero, which is what the photon is doing. Anyway, it's been fun discussing physics with you guys. If anyone has any other questions or comments or topics or statements or what have you, please feel free. This is the Limark Technical Net.
K2NBB.
Yes, Bob.
Yes, on a humorous note, I remember seeing a cartoon once. I mean, you were talking a while back about long equations and short equations. It might have been Farside, one of my favorites, Gary Larson, I'm not sure. But it was this long equation on a blackboard. And then at a certain part, it just said, and then a miracle happened. Anyway, back to you, Roy. Back to Ned.
I have a similar joke, but hopefully better.
Okay, Ed, let us have it.
It's a little risque, but we can handle it. A mathematician and an engineer were in this room talking. Door opens, an attractive young woman walks in and says she was directed to, at fixed time intervals, to travel exactly half the distance to the two guys. Would they want to play along with this experiment? And the mathematician says, wait a minute, that never converges, she'll never get here. But the engineer says, come on, let's do it, we'll get close enough.
That is a good one, Ed, and I don't think it was risque. We've mentioned Zeno's paradox before.
Is a paradox you and a business buddy?
I actually have heard that one before, Ed.
I didn't say it was original.
Okay, I must say it's not as popular as the people who tell me that they don't have patience like me.
Okay, to NBB.
Yes, Bob.
Do you all know the one about Werner Heisenberg being pulled over by the police? And they accused him of speeding, how fast you were going? He says, no, but I know where I am. And then the guy said, you're going 85 miles an hour. I said, oh my God, where am I?
Okay, among physicists, that would be funny. Among people who don't know what the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, I don't know.
I figured there were enough people on this net that might get that joke. Back to Ned.
I appreciate it, thank you.
I appreciate it, but I'm just so confused.
About what?
About whether I'm going fast or fixed in position.
The answer to all those questions is yes.
It's like my philosophy final. N1 whitey-white.
It's all relative. Just remember that.
Keep my relatives out of this.
As Archie Bunker once said, I shouldn't have been studying for a math test. I should have been studying relativity. Because the boss's nephew got the job.
Now, that was a great show. I miss it. Anyway, once again, this is AC2GS, and my name is Roy, and this is the Limewalk Technical Mess, meeting here every Sunday night at 8 p.m., except next Sunday night, we're going to be on hiatus. You guys will find other ways to amuse yourself, and I will return to the 18th century, where I just popped out of at 7:46 p.m. tonight. But until then, if anyone has any questions or topics or comments, please share. Just hit that push to talk button.
Why 18th century in particular?
I don't know. I just place it at a point where technology was basically at the level of a candle.
All right, no, I thought maybe you had something more specific in mind.
Nah, I was just going for, you know, before radio, before, you can go down a list. It doesn't really work when you get down to specifics, but it's just shorthand for me of it's an opportunity to miss all of my technological toys. Which I think has value in and of itself. We tend to take these things for granted, And every so often when our toys are removed, you know, we better appreciate them.
Hey, Roy, you have my email. Do me a favor. When you get a chance, send me an email answering, in your case, how is this weekend different from other Rusty Sunners? I mean, I just want to know the logistics you went through.
So, okay, the COVID virus pretty much blew everything up as it has for a long time. So, it's kind of the new normal, unfortunately. I hope we get rid of the new normal real soon.
No, I'm just curious. Don't take up the net time on it. Send me an email with exactly how, for better or worse, you did it this year. So, I'm just personal curiosity, nothing to do with the net.
Okay, no, understood. So once again, this is AC2GS, and we have about 15 odd minutes before Paul's SpaceNet report. I assume that Andy is not going to be joining us. I'll let the mic drop for a second in case he's listening, but we'll see what happens. Let me drop it. Okay, so that's not going to happen tonight. He'll be back in a few weeks, because we won't be back next Sunday anyway. If anyone else has any questions or comments or topics or even want to talk about COVID-19, what have you, we can do that. Or otherwise, I have some news items for the science talk. So it's up to you guys.
WV2EAV with a COVID-19 question.
Sure, Ed.
A group out of University of California, San Francisco, put out a paper that's very, very, very mass positive by the lead researcher, Monica Gandhi. Do you know anything more about it than I read? Because I found that absolutely, what little I read, I found fascinating. Do you have anything more? Do you think anybody listening in might be interested?
I'm sure there are people interested. When did this get published? Because I do not recall seeing it.
Came out during the week, and basically, in short, this group, I've heard this woman on NPR before, and she said it's beginning to look like wearing a mask is very effective, even if people around you aren't. It is. Not only protects other people from you, it does actually protect you from other people. Not great, but it does definitely reduce the, quote, viral load, which leads to milder cases. And the newest one is saying that they're getting to the point, they're not there yet, of almost proving that wearing a mask many, many cases has reduced the viral load to the point that people test positive with antibodies and no symptoms. And I think that's why Redfield made a comment about it to be as good as a vaccine.
Okay, I mean, that makes sense. And I did hear his statement about how masks might be more effective than a vaccine may be. Ever since, they started to push the idea of face masks, it's not a perfect solution. I don't think there is a perfect solution. I don't know when or if there's going to be a perfect solution. But I think it's reasonable, and you can kind of see it inferred in most of the statistical data. If you keep looking at curves of infections when large regions institute global face covers, you see the drop. It takes a little bit of time because everything's on a delay, and then you see a drop. So I would not be at all amazed to find out that masks have become a significant preventative. And to a degree, I think that's one of the reasons why New York is doing as well as it is presently, because I think, although there are some people out there who just aren't paying attention, I think there's a lot more paying attention in the, New York than other states of the union, unfortunately.
New York got scared and
so they're listening to the experts.
Fear is a very, very useful motivator. So if fear works for you, as long as it doesn't paralyze you, then so be it. But, you know, there have been communities that should have been frightened also. But unfortunately, whenever you mix politics and science, it's not good for either.
I think we're going to come up with number three. You want any number one and two?
Yeah, sure.
I know police officers who say they've never had to unbuckle a dead person after a car crash. I know park rangers who said they've never fished a body out of the water wearing a life jacket. And I think we're coming up with number three. I think you can see where I'm going, but I'm not sure. I haven't had time to really put this together.
Yeah, I mean, the good point is eventually people get the message. Unfortunately, they don't usually get it very quickly. There was a big whoop-de-doo about motorcycle helmets and people demanded their American freedom, that a helmet would stifle their freedom. And occasionally those people would fall off their motorcycles and injure their head and mumble, "I think it's time for a helmet." You know, given enough time, people learn from their mistakes. The problem is whether we have enough time for all this.
First person story, ready?
Sure.
I'm dead serious. This happened years and years ago, but nothing has changed. Driving home from work, I was living not too far from you. I was living in Coney Island. I'm driving on the Bell Parkway to the Brighton area, and it's kind of bad weather, and I'm saying, what is that idiot doing on a motorcycle in this swamp? Another car, a stereotypical Freddie Prinze slummobile, is weaving in and out of traffic, obviously probably without good windshield wipers, and I'll bet they never saw the motorcyclist. Sideswipe them. And now this guy is going in his motorcycle, literally going head over heels, right in front of me. So I read somewhere that people usually survive the first hit. It's the second one that kills them. So I pointedly followed him and stopped the car to block him from traffic. Let me let it drop. I get out of the car and say, "Oh God, this is going to be horrible." I was never so thrilled to see somebody see my headlights and panic. I said, no, it's okay, I'm stopped. And he said, he said, "I think my leg is broken." And I start laughing. That's pretty good. I thought you were dead. So the moral of the story, his helmet saved his life. I'm absolutely 100% sure of that. It would have been horrible.
Yeah, I mean, some of this sounds like it should be common sense. I'm a little confused where people have I don't know if it's just doubts or paranoia or what the hell's going on, but, you know, it doesn't take that much to me of a leap of faith to think that a well-insulated helmet will protect your head from flying across a road.
Yeah, WB2KWC. Yes, but it might be uncomfortable and it might mess my hair up.
Well, yeah, I guess there's always that. So you got to get your priorities straight. Although, can you imagine how much these guys' hair would be messed up without the helmet entirely?
Comment in one whitey white.
Yeah, thanks.
So in a previous life, I had an acquaintance, a flight attendant. Her boyfriend was a Harley rider. She was all into the Harley gear and the Harley attire.